All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Thanks for joining us. I am Jim Fossone, Lieutenant JG type, piloting the Veterans Radio patrol boat this evening on the WAAM airwaves. We've got a great program for the day. We're going to talk to Kayla Williams. She is a linguist and former intelligence specialist in the United States Army. She wrote about her experiences in Iraq in her book, Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. And Dale spoke to her in 2006. And I recently had the opportunity to talk to her in her role as director of VA Center for Women Veterans and what the VA is doing to help out our women veterans. So sit back and enjoy.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. And we are getting ready to welcome our first guest of the evening, and that is Kayla Williams. Ms. Williams, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Kayla wrote, I found, a really fascinating book entitled Love... Where did it go?
Love My Rifle More Than You.
That's right. Love My Rifle More Than You. And Kayla, you are a member of the 101st Airborne Division in Iraq?
Air Assault. Absolutely.
And my question, I guess, the book is really fascinating because you talk about being young and female in the U.S. Army. And I've asked my co-host this evening is Lieutenant Colonel Christine Cook, but I don't think she has to go by Lieutenant Colonel this evening.
No, don't call me ma'am.
And because we wanted to talk a little bit about the issue of being a woman in the military. We've talked with Christine before about being an officer in the military. And one of the things that we were talking about a little bit earlier is that it sounds like your experience was a little bit different.
Well, I don't know much about Christine's experiences, but I know that for me, being a woman in the military in some ways was very conflicting because it did help me grow so much in terms of my own self-confidence, my sense of self, my own strength, my knowledge of my abilities. I'm incredibly proud of my service. I am, despite the difficulties, very glad that I went to Iraq. I was proud to be a part of the 101st. But there were also difficulties. The military is still strongly male-dominated. I think women make up about 15% of the Army today, and being a minority has its challenges. And there were definitely some times that it was very tough to be a woman in the military.
Well, Kayla, tell us how you got involved in the Army in the first place.
I joined a little differently than many other enlisted soldiers. I had a college degree. I had worked for several years. I owned my own home, had a steady boyfriend, all the things you're supposed to be doing in your early 20s. And yet I also just didn't feel really satisfied. I felt like I'd always picked the easy thing to do and was only doing what I was supposed to do and hadn't really challenged myself. I lost my job and was struggling to figure out what to do next. I wanted to go on to graduate school and didn't know how I was going to finance that. The military has a lot of great educational benefits, and I learned they were willing to pay me to learn a foreign language. There were a lot of benefits, and it also offered me a way to give back to the greater community that has done so much for all of us. And so I ended up joining the Army in 2000. Bill Clinton was still in office. The thought of going to war was a possibility, but it seemed very remote. And I was actually learning Arabic at the Defense Language Institute on when September 11th happened, and I knew that my military experience was going to be very different than I had initially thought it might be.
Oh.
Well, that's for everyone, I think.
It was very surreal to watch the footage of 9/11 on Arabic TV, which was all that we could get in our classroom at that point.
It must have been very edifying. I know listening to Al Jazeera is just something that can't be fathomed unless you actually do it in country there, because they have a completely different slant on everything that
happens.
True,
and they fascinate me because they also infuriate a lot of Arabs.
Yes,
they make everybody mad. So.
Well, after you went through the language school, and obviously with your MOS, that was, you knew where you were off to.
Yes.
and going and becoming part of the 101st. When exactly did you ship over to Iraq?
Well, I left for Kuwait in February of 2003, and then our whole division was entered Iraq right away on March 19th. Was it that we all invaded?
Yes.
So, was one of the first groups to cross the berm.
And then you ended up in Baghdad.
Yes, we ended up in Baghdad and then pushed on to Mosul and then out to Tal Afar. And I spent a long time on an LPOP farther out even than Tal Afar, close to the Syrian border.
And an LPOP
is... Listening Post, Observation Post. Sorry, okay. I assumed since this was Veterans Radio, I could use
that. We
jargon.
Can do that. Yeah.
No, you can do that, but a lot of our listeners are civilians, and we want to make sure that they understand what we're talking about.
And you were signal intelligence for the most part, and so you were listening to radio to try to find out if there was any information that we could use on our end. Correct?
Right, that was our mission, to intercept enemy communications. And I feel very lucky to have been part of the initial invasion and to have been in Iraq when there was that initial period of great hope and, you know, a real belief that things could get better. That was really incredibly rewarding. Plus, at that early stage in the invasion, we still went out a lot and got to communicate with the local people quite a bit. And when I was out on the side of the mountain, past Tal Afar, you know, we were fairly isolated, but we had a lot of contact with the local people, and I really got to talk to the Iraqis quite a bit, which I'm very grateful for. It's unusual for, I think, a lot of soldiers, because not enough of our soldiers speak Arabic, and I feel very lucky to have been in those positions.
Actually, I wanted to ask a little bit more about a group of people that you worked with that were not Arab-speaking. They were Yazidis?
The Yazidis are an interesting minority. They're actually, most of them are ethnically Kurdish, but their religion is not Islam. Their religion probably dates back to Zoroastrianism, and it's just amazing that it's survived this long. They're very interesting people that they've been persecuted for probably, you know, thousands of years and have managed to hang on out there on the edge of nowhere.
And you had a wonderful story where you were talking with somebody named, I think, Jazu, is
mm-hmm.
that correct? And you were waxing eloquent about how wonderful the life was, that there were beautiful sunsets and that there was much more simple than what we go through in the United States. And then he basically said, we have no electricity.
Right. I was romanticizing this kind of pastoral lifestyle. And, you know, here sometimes things can seem so overwhelming. I have to check my email and my voicemail and my other email and my other voicemail and check the bank account and pay the bills and follow up with people. And, you know, there are just so many little things that you have to be on top of constantly. And I'm like, wow, that's great. You know, you take your sheep out and you don't have to worry about anything, you know, in any of these little niggling things. You're here in this beautiful landscape. And he's like, yeah, we don't have electricity. And I thought, wow, I'm retarded. I'm, you know, I'm an idiot. I'm the things that Americans worry about or think are bad are so completely different than what people worry about in the third world. I mean, here, people get upset if it takes too long to get their latte. And, you know, this guy's worried about being able to feed his kids. I mean, he's wearing plastic sandals, and those are the best shoes he's got. And they don't have electricity or refrigerator or light after dark. And it's just a completely different world.
And he asked for the cardboard boxes when you left so he could make a floor.
Yes. Yes, he did.
Wow. And that brings us, though, to Jimmy. Jimmy was... free market economist in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, budding capitalist.
Yes, yes. And he decided that you were extremely poor, is that correct?
Right. He would rent a taxi for the day and bring up things to sell to us, that anything that he thought we might want. We ended up with some coolers, and he would bring up blocks of ice, and he would bring up soda and trinkets, anything that he thought we might want. And trying to figure out what the market would bear was definitely difficult for the Iraqi people, and they're trying to figure out how much to charge soldiers for things. And so he asked me once how much money I made, and I didn't know how to answer because I was afraid that he would misinterpret what I was saying and suddenly jack up the prices. So I was trying to explain that I made about $2,000 a month, but I had, you know, a $600 house payment that I still had to make even though I was deployed, and a $300 car payment and my car insurance, and so I'm going through and listing my expenses and explaining to him that even though it may sound like a lot of money to him on their scale, that because we still have to pay for a lot of things, it really isn't that much. And he's looking at me and he's like, oh, and you have to pay for food and you have electricity. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely, all of these things. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. And he handed me a soda. He gave me a free soda because, and I was really embarrassed because on one hand, absolutely, lower enlisted soldiers are not paid nearly enough for what they're expected to do. I think E4s and below with dependents can qualify for food stamps, which I think is absolutely outrageous. But at the same time, the level of poverty that these people experience is just worlds away from what we think of as lack in this country.
Right.
We're talking with Kayla Williams, the author of not a brand new book, but it's entitled Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army.
It is newly out in paperback.
All right. There we can start a tour. if you want to give Kayla a call or ask her a question, give us a call here at the studio locally. That's 822-1600. If you're listening on the Internet, you can give us a call at 866-477-9100. And getting back to Kayla, as we were reading the book, Christine and I were talking about the chronological aspects of it, and we were trying to figure out where you were when you were there. So when you first went in, were you in Baghdad for a long period of time?
No, not long enough. That was actually one of the things that was very frustrating for me, and I understand that I was lower enlisted, that I couldn't see the big picture, and so I don't know what the high-ranking officers, you know, what drove their decision-making process. But it was very frustrating for me to go out into a community with the infantry and start to get to know the people and get them to start to trust us, to build some relationships and hope that we could start to win the hearts and minds, and then get yanked and thrown into a whole other community and just to get moved around so quickly. That was very frustrating. I think that we were probably in Baghdad for just a few weeks at, I would guess, April, the end of April probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you went up to Mosul?
Mm-hmm. Not for long. Pushed straight out to Talavar, and then I was on the side of Sinjar Mountain for several months.
But you were in different locations on Sinjar Mountain, is that correct?
Yes. Two locations on Sinjar Mountain, and then we moved around to several other in more insignificant areas for a few weeks at a time to try to map what was out there and see if we could find a place that we should be in, and spent some time in Sinjar itself and spent some time just scattered all over that area. And then eventually we went back to Mosul, and I spent the last couple months in Mosul itself.
Right, and that's when you had a human experience that was horrible.
Yes.
Human intelligence, that is. Would you describe a little bit, since I think that's actually very apropos come from what happened with Bush this week regarding his desire to let go of the Geneva Conventions on certain things?
Sure. As you mentioned earlier, my job was primarily signals intelligence. That was what I was trained to do. That was what I knew how to do. I was not trained in human intelligence collection or in interrogations at all. So I haven't read their FM. I don't really know the rules. But while I was in Mosul, I was asked to assist in an interrogation as a female who spoke Arabic. I thought that this might be a good sign that maybe we were interrogating a female and that they wanted a woman there to do the right thing. And I was unfortunately very mistaken when I got down there. The NCO in charge told me that he wanted me there to basically to humiliate male prisoners, that they would remove the clothing from a detainee and then his blindfold, so I would be the first thing that he would see, and that we were then supposed to mock him and degrade his masculinity in an attempt to break his spirit and make him more likely to give up information with intelligence value. And I was really thrown off because I didn't know if this was standard, if this was how things were supposed to happen. I didn't know what to make of it at all, and I had not yet been promoted. I was as a specialist, and this was a non-commissioned officer telling me what to do. And so I did sit through it. I didn't feel good at it. I never practiced mocking or degrading somebody, so I didn't really feel like I knew what I was doing, but I did sit through it and waited until after it was over instead of, you know, downplaying his authority in front of detainees or his own soldiers. And after the experience was over, I pulled him aside and spoke to him privately, told him that I thought that he might be violating the Geneva Conventions, that certainly he was turning anybody who might be innocent into a terrorist by the time they got released. And I didn't think that it was right, and I didn't want to participate again. And he didn't ever ask me to participate again. And there were a lot of other little things that just seemed wrong about the way that the detainees were treated. And I was actually pleased to see that the military system worked, that the Army learned pretty quickly that things weren't happening the way they should have been happening. They moved very quickly to put other people in charge and make sure that the problems, the abuses, stopped.
Right. But unfortunately, it did come from the top down because there was a confusion over Bush writing a memorandum stating that we could use non-Geneva Convention things in the case of terrorists. But the truth was that we probably should never get away from Geneva Conventions.
That's absolutely what I believe and what I hope most other people believe as well. And definitely talking to the warrant officer who's in charge of that location, he said that he later said that he had felt a lot of confusion, that he was getting the impression from other connections that he had in the intelligence community and from higher that the rules were shifting. And you know, from both a moral perspective, I think that's unfortunate, and from an international law perspective, I think that that's a bad idea. And the whole thing has been, this has just been such a disaster. And the other thing that I think people never, I certainly don't hear anybody talking about, but that I wonder about, is what it does to the soldiers who are conducting these sorts of interrogations. If you deal with other human beings for a year or more, in those terms where it's acceptable to degrade them, it's acceptable to try to break them constantly, and then you go home to a spouse, to little children, to a normal life, what does that do to you? I really think it's dangerous for everyone involved.
I think we have a topic for another show.
Oh, yeah. That's a good long discussion.
Is it something, I mean, if there are people coming back already with difficulties from post-traumatic, that would certainly seem to me to be some sort of stress that's going to rear its ugly head somewhere down the road.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Now, do we have to go to a break?
Pre-cone.
Okay. Because there's an aspect of that I would like to continue talking about, and we can do that after.
Okay, we're going to go to our break a little bit early, actually, and everybody's ready over there. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and I'm your host this evening, Dale Throneberry, and joining me in the studio is Christine Cook. And joining us on the phone is Kayla Williams, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. And Christine, you had a question for Kayla.
Well, actually, it was kind of a continuation of what we were just discussing about, which was the concept of people who are the interrogators who treat people as less than human for a year and then come back and try to deal with their own families. I think one of the ways that Army people in general, when they are in a deployed scenario, can deal with this is by kind of dehumanizing our enemy.
Absolutely.
The problem is that dehumanizing can only work so much. And as you were saying, we were also trying to win the hearts and minds of these people, at least for a time. And I actually think that's still the case. But to dehumanize,
it's a lot to ask of soldiers, I think. Mm-hmm. Especially a lot of soldiers are between the ages of 18 and 25, and There's a book, actually, that I have to recommend. I know I should plug my own, right? But it's called The Zanzibar Chest, and the journalist, Aidan Hartley, who wrote it, really fascinating guy. He had a lot of amazing things to say, and he quoted a UN official who was in, I think, Rwanda, as saying that the UN soldiers there were expected to have a gun in one hand and a spoon in the other. And that really hit home for me. I felt that way, too. We were doing propane distribution, and we're supposed to win the hearts and minds and not dehumanize the other, but at the same time, these people are potentially your enemy. They might be trying to kill you. If you let your guard down, you might get killed. You might let your buddy get killed. You always have to be on the lookout. You always have to be wary. And I think that balance, that tightrope that you have to walk, is just incredibly difficult for soldiers.
Another author that we had on the program had talked about the idea that the Americans' foreign policy was at the end of the gun of that 19, 20-year-old kid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how do they react if somebody approaches them? And I'm sure that you had your own stories about fear, and you know, when somebody was approaching you, it turned out to be nothing, but you don't know.
Right. It's incredibly difficult. And if you always deal with people by pointing your gun at them because they might be a threat, well, that is going to affect how they look at you and all other American soldiers. But if you don't always stay on guard, then the one time that it's the wrong person, you know, well, it's a permanent mistake.
And actually, you came up with something very interesting at one point when you were ordered by a lieutenant up in Mount Sinjar to put up all of the security measures, and that this had happened before anything was really happening, but you had to do security because you were right on the Syrian border.
Mm-hmm.
But then you mentioned that, you know, it was once we put the security in that we started having problems.
It seemed like a self-perpetuating cycle. And it, at a certain point, it didn't necessarily matter who started it. You know, it just would just keep going. One person would shoot at one American convoy, so we would go knock down three doors to try to figure out which house it came from. So then you have three families that are angry. And then so then, do you know what I'm saying? It just would spiral. It would just perpetuate. And we were where we were among the Yazidis who loved us and wanted us to stay there forever, and we're constructing fighting positions by piling rocks up, which we have no skill in. We don't know how to make rock walls. We don't know what we're doing. And they're like, oh, you don't know what you're doing. Let us build that for you. And it just seems so surreal and ridiculous to me. Like, okay, thanks. You can build me a fighting position to protect me from you. And, you know, the people, those particular people, they loved us because they had access to a shrine that they hadn't been able to go to in a long time. They finally felt free from persecution. And so then what do? We start to harden our position and make it harder for them to access their shrine. It just didn't seem to make sense. But, of course, I understand from a military perspective, you have to protect your own troops. But I could see how we were, by doing what we had to do for us, what was safe for us, we were making things worse for our relationship with them. And it's just, I don't know how you could get away from it. And I guess it seems in a lot of ways to be something much bigger than just this problem in Iraq. I mean, do you want soldiers to be involved in nation building? The Army's mission statement, I was told, is to fight and win our nation's wars. That's our job, and that's what we're trained to do. We aren't necessarily trained to go in and create systems and institutions and to rebuild shattered societies. There are people and institutions who are trained in that, but certainly it wasn't part of my training. I like the thought of helping people and trying to make a positive difference instead of just going over and shooting everybody. But if that's what our nation wants the Army's role to be, if that's what our nation decides that they want the military to be in a position to do, then I really think that our training from day one for new soldiers has to incorporate more of that. And I understand, I guess, the Army is such a huge bureaucracy that it takes a long time for changes to trickle down. But I think it's a question the nation has to decide together. What do we want the military to do?
Mm-hmm. And do we make infantrymen do a civil affairs job?
Exactly.
I mean, we're talking with Kayla Williams, the author of Love My Rifle More Than You, which is now out in paperback.
I was able, while we were in Baghdad, I actually went out on combat foot patrols with the infantry, which was an amazing experience for me. I think not many female soldiers get that experience. And as an Arabic linguist, I did get to do that. And it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in the military because I could see the immediate impact of what I was doing. Unlike in signals intelligence, when you send up a report and you don't necessarily ever hear if it was useful.
Kayla Williams, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the Army.
Well, that's the first portion of our interview with Kayla Williams about her experiences in Iraq as a Army veteran. And right after the news, you'll hear some more from her in her role as director of the VA's Women Center.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio on Wham Radio out of Ann Arbor, where I am Jim Fossone. It's great to be with you for this interview with Kayla Williams, who's the director of the VA's Women's Center, and hear about what VA is doing for our female veterans. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Kayla Williams. She is the director of VA Center for Women Veterans. Ms. Williams, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a great opportunity to talk about the good things that VA is doing relative to women veterans. But before we get into that, Director Williams, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your education is.
Sure. So I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and went to college in Bowling Green State University, got my bachelor's degree in English literature, and then spent a few years working in the nonprofit sector doing fundraising for public TV and radio stations, and then ended up joining the Army out of Tampa, Florida.
And you spent about 5 years enlisted in the Army. Tell us a little bit about your MOS and your assignments.
So I'd gotten my bachelor's degree in English literature, which felt a little bit like cheating. They gave me a college degree for reading books, which is my favorite hobby. And when I was looking for what to do next, I wanted a challenge. I wanted to be able to access the GI Bill to continue my education in the long run. And I was really excited when I found out that the Army offered the opportunity for me to learn a foreign language. So I chose to become a linguist. I did signals intelligence and was assigned Arabic. I was actually learning Arabic at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California on 9/11. So in that moment, I knew my military career was going to be very different than I might otherwise have expected. I was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault, and spent about a year total in the Middle East, took part of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, and came home in 2004.
Well, it's, yeah, as you say, your career, military career took a big deviation. Tell us what you did during your year with Operation Iraqi Freedom.
I took part of the initial invasion, and we drove up from Kuwait to Baghdad, where I went on combat foot patrols with the infantry, something that at the time was fairly unusual for female soldiers, has since become utterly banal. But in those early days, it was still under the old regulations that barred women from direct ground combat arms, jobs, and units. But the need for Arabic speakers so outweighed any policies in place that I ended up going out to do that direct translation between the Iraqi people and infantry troops. That was really the most rewarding part of my military career, getting to see the infantrymen doing their jobs, getting to see my impact on operations and know that I was making a difference every day. We then pushed farther north up to Mosul and Tal Afar and beyond. I spent a lot of time on Sinjar Mountain where the Yazidis live. So if you follow the news, I'm sure you can guess that it's been very emotionally challenging for me to watch what's happened in that region in the years since I came home. And while we were up in that area, I was actually able to do more of the job that I had been trained to do, which was the signals intelligence. And it was very austere out on the side of the mountain for many months. I was the only woman with first about 7 men and then about 20 men, very forward deployed, probably half an hour even from helicopter or quick reaction force if anything had gone south. But it was a fairly safe area. The last few months that I was in Iraq, I spent in Mosul where we had more amenities like running water and electricity, which was terrific. But the insurgent activity was on the uptick at that stage, and being in a city, we got mortared, and so that was the downside to being in a different location towards the end.
Well, it's a long ways from the Midwest in Ohio to those those duty stations. One of the things I'm interested in, Kayla, you had mentioned at the outset that you did this to get a little GI Bill activity and be able to do some further education. Did you have that opportunity?
I did. So when I left active duty, it was in part because the man that I fell in love with was severely wounded in Iraq, and I left active duty to help him on his road to recovery. He was at Walter Reed. When I left active duty, I joined him in the D.C. area and tried, without much success, to learn how to be a good caregiver to him while also reintegrating into civilian life myself. I did use my GI Bill to get my master's degree in international relations at American University, And with that increased education, was able to spend about 8.5 years doing research at the RAND Corporation.
Well, our veteran radio listeners are very familiar with RAND Corporation. We've had some of their senior scientists and researchers on previously to talk about the report. So I'm sure that that time at RAND for you was a great opportunity to think deeply and research in depth of veteran and military issues. Was that the space that they had you working in?
Yes, I came on initially to do work in international security and defense policy, but as my passion for veterans issues really deepened as I tried to navigate the space myself and help my husband navigate the space, I was very, very lucky that they were supportive of me gradually shifting my research portfolio more in that direction, and I was able to do some research on service member and veteran psychological health and traumatic brain injury, as well as use of education benefits and more. And that experience, I think, really prepared me well for the next stage in my career. It grounded me very deeply in the importance of providing evidence-based interventions and not just kind of throwing everything at the wall to see what would stick.
Well, you've had a very distinguished career up to the point, certainly, of becoming the director of the VA Center for Women Veterans. It includes such things as being a member of the VA Survey of Experiences of Returning Veterans Study Advisory Board, a Truman National Security Project Fellow, a 2013 White House Woman Veteran Champion of Change, a 2015 Lincoln Award recipient, and an author. But let's move to the Center of Women Veterans that the VA has in place, and tell us a little bit about what its mission is.
The center was actually established by law in the mid-90s because, I believe, of the first Gulf War. As the number of women in the military was climbing, and folks were becoming aware of the fact that since VA was established, when the number of women in the military was limited by law to just 2%, many of the facilities and services and programs just weren't optimized to serve that portion of the population. And at this point, the women are one of the fastest growing subgroups within the larger veteran population. The number of women veterans is climbing while the number of male veterans is declining. So we're just under 10% of the veteran population now and projected to grow up to 15%, matching our representation in the total force by probably 2035 or so. And the Center for Women Veterans serves to monitor and coordinate VA's administration of healthcare and benefit services and programs for women veterans, advocate for cultural transformation, both inside VA and in the general public, to recognize the service and contributions of women vets and military women, and to raise awareness of the responsibility to treat women veterans with dignity and respect. I am, in addition to, you know, doing this in my professional life, I am a VA user. I use VA healthcare exclusively. I have for several years now. As I mentioned, I used my GI Bill benefits in the past. I've used Home Loan Guarantee. So I know very, very viscerally how important VA can be for veterans in ensuring that they can transition to the next phase of their lives successfully and thrive. I also have personally experienced some of the ways that we don't always get it right, especially for women. There are times when I go into VA for medical appointments and the first person who sees me walk in asks if I'm there with my husband, for example. So those little things that I'm able to just blow off because I'm at a pretty good place in my life could be really deeply off-putting for somebody with a trauma history. So we are working very hard on that cultural transformation and employee education to ensure that all of our employees recognize women as veterans and greet them as such when they come in the door, and really afford them the same dignity and respect that our male comrades receive kind of by default.
We have the opportunity here to talk to veterans all around the country, and you're in the Washington, D.C. area. I can tell you that out in other parts of the country, certainly in your home state of Ohio and elsewhere where there aren't a lot of active duty bases and there are not a lot of active duty service members, I think that I'll call it loneliness, is felt by women veteran even more, that there just isn't a whole lot of community. And so the work that you're doing to add a little bit of community in this cultural transformation outside those active duty areas is probably even more important than that that's being done where there are active duty military.
Another thing that I've brought to the center since taking over about 2 years ago is use of the digital domain to play a component in that effort that you're talking about. So we know that social media can be an important way for folks, especially those who are in more rural areas, more remote areas, or those who have mobility challenges and can't necessarily get to spaces that are occupied physically by other vets as easily as others. So we have been launching as many ways as we can to get folks, women veterans, connected to the information resources that they need using digital means. It's not, of course, the only method we're going to use. I know not everyone is online, but I will say my mom posts on Facebook more than I do. So I know that, you know, it can be folks of all generations. So if anybody's interested, they can go to our website, which is va.gov/womenvet. And sign up to get newsletters in a number of different areas. We send out a weekly newsletter, and then we send out monthly updates on events and medical research related to women veterans and messages from the center and a quarterly resources update. And we've also finally gotten approval, very, very excited about this, from VA to launch our own social media accounts. So you can follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. Both of those are at VA Women Vets, and you can see all of the news and information and resources that we post there and engage in dialogue and conversation with other women veterans around the country and around the world. And all of those news and resources are curated by women veterans for women veterans.
And I have to say that having been on that site, I encourage our veteran radio listeners to go there to va.gov/womenvet. The right-hand navigation bar will clearly lay out a sort of a site navigation and be able to get you to whether it's frequently asked questions or events that are coming up or the social media, Facebook, Twitter, the blogs, that sort of stuff. It's really pretty easy to find, and I commend you on that. Sometimes VA has, or just government in general, has such complicated websites. You can't find what you want, and you just leave in frustration. So I'm glad you're working to avoid that.
Thanks. It was one of the first things I tackled when I came on board was revamping the site.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the projects and programs that the Center for Women Veterans has to draw folks in and make sure that the messages are being communicated?
Sure. So one of the things that I started thinking about right away was how to connect with people emotionally, because I definitely remember from my time as an enlisted soldier that, you know, PowerPoint is not the way to get through to people, and a dry recitation of facts and figures is not necessarily the best way to communicate a compelling message. So last year in 2017, I partnered with the Veteran Artist Project to put on an exhibit of art by women veterans. We did a call for submissions. We got submissions from over 100 women vets around the country and selected 10 that we created storyboards of. So these really nice posters that featured an image of the artist's work, photos of her in and out of uniform, and a brief bio. And we had those hung in 10 VA medical centers around the country throughout March, which is Women's History Month, and then sent them on to additional sites over the course of the year. This was aimed at helping our VA employees and providers, as well as some of our older male veteran patients, recognize that women are veterans and learn more about our strength, diversity, and resilience, and also help women vets, when they enter a VA, feel more welcome and recognized by seeing images of themselves, of other women veterans, up on the walls. That was picked up and did go beyond VA as well. We had them displayed in some Starbucks locations, on the Intrepid during Fleet Week, in the lobby of the Broadway Musical Bandstand and in the Patriots outpost of the PGA at Sawgrass. So I was really excited at how well-received that effort was. And we followed it this year with the Women Veteran Athletes Initiative. So in partnership with Team Red, White, and Blue, or Team RWB, we did a series of portraits of 10 women veteran athletes. Our photographer was Stacey Pearsall, who is herself a woman veteran and renowned photographer. Those storyboards were featured in 10 VAs again throughout March, which is Women's History Month, and they're now traveling to additional sites around the country over the course of the next year. We also featured online extensive digital support package for this, so you can listen to podcasts or read blogs by and about the women veterans and see additional portraits of them. I was so excited that when we chose these women, we were really able to highlight a diverse group of women veterans that really reflect our population. So we have women vets from all five branches of service, different eras, different ethnicities and backgrounds, and different ability levels. And by showcasing how we have women veterans who are in wheelchairs and of a variety of different body types and ability levels, still engaging in athletic pursuits, we're hoping to, again, showcase that strength and resilience that women veterans have, and also encourage women veterans and all veterans to stay healthy and active throughout their life cycle with the support of VA, adaptive sports, or rec therapy programs if necessary, or in partnership with community organizations like Team RWB because of the importance that, physical activity can have on wellness throughout one's life cycle. And these women are absolutely inspirational. One of them, Angela Madsen, who is in a wheelchair, has rode solo across the Atlantic Ocean. Another, Candace Caesar, was once told she would never walk again, went on to participate in 25 marathons in 25 states over 3 years. So seeing how these women are overcoming adversity to stay healthy and active and maintain this incredibly positive attitude, it has genuinely changed my life. So I've ended up losing about 10 pounds because my excuses about not going to the gym are totally gone. If Angela Madsen can row across the Atlantic Ocean without a support boat, and she's wheelchair-bound, I can make it to the gym even when I'm not feeling great. So increased my own fitness level.
Proving guilt has worked on the director of the VA Center for Women and Veterans, Kayla Williams, who we're talking to here on Veterans Radio. And I want to say, again, both the Women Veteran Athletes Initiative as well as the Women Veterans Art Exhibit is prominently displayed on the website in that navigation bar that's easy to find and work your way through. So I'd really encourage people to take a look at that. I'd like you to talk a little bit, too, if you would, about the National Women Veterans Summit of 2017 and the various webcasts that are available.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last time that VA had a national level summit for women veterans had been in 2011. So I started planning one very soon after coming on board. And unfortunately, the best laid plans of mice and men, as they say, go awry. So it was scheduled in Houston in August of 2017. And unfortunately, Hurricane Harvey bore down on us and forced us to close down early. I think that the universe was afraid of having 800 women vets in one place at one time. So
that may have been it. Or Mother Nature just wanted you all to disperse. So,
but I refused to allow the weather to defeat us, so worked with our subject matter experts across VA and community partners to hold the sessions by cyber seminar after the fact, and we've collected those on the website in the page devoted to the summit so folks can go on and listen to cyber seminars about women veterans employment, entrepreneurship, and many, many other topics that I hope will be helpful for them as they want to learn more about what VA and other partners have available for them or what issues we're concerned about.
Well, I think it's a great way to reach people who would not have otherwise been able to make it, and those things are still there and very relevant and very usable now in this format. Kayla, I guess one of the questions I have for you is relative to your role as the director here and your interaction or what types of interaction you might have with the Secretary of the VA as you try to advance this cultural transformation?
So the director of the Center for Women Veterans serves as the primary advisor to the secretary on department policies, programs, and legislation that affect women veterans. And we also work closely with the other internal VA offices, both the three major administrations of health benefits and the National Cemetery Administration, as well as other staff offices on programs that serve women veterans and care and services and benefits for our women veterans to ensure that we're doing the best job we possibly can to ensure equity between men and women in accessing and using and being satisfied with all of the resources that we have available to veterans. We also liaison with other federal agencies and state and local organizations, as well as those in the nonprofit community to encourage them to optimize their programming to serve women veterans as a core part of their constituency.
Well, I think it's really, this work is so important, not only for the women veterans, but for all Americans. I'm a spouse of a female veteran. There are plenty of dads and uncles and mothers and sisters around who need to understand the image of the woman veteran today and the vital role they play in the national defense and the immense contributions that they're making to the country and the corresponding obligation of the country then to take care of those women veterans. So I think the part of the message hopefully you're getting out to people is to think about women veterans in that larger context.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for your wife's service and for your service as a family member, in addition to so many other ways. You know, another component that I think you alluded to, but I'll make a little more explicit about the importance of some of the work that we do is that it benefits more than just women veterans. So I'll give an example. Years ago, before I came on board at VA, I was pushing from the outside as an advocate hard to encourage VA medical centers to get changing tables in bathrooms because from my perspective, this was important because women are more likely to be the primary caregivers of small children, and because women vets skew younger than male veterans, and so we're more likely to have small children. And having to change a baby's diaper on the floor of a bathroom is just really disgusting. Nobody wants to have to do that. And that's something that we've made tremendous progress on. It makes a huge difference. But it hasn't just affected young women. It has also been beneficial to our male veterans, both younger male veterans who are bringing in their own kids, and in today's era when you may have grandparents who are serving as the caregivers to their grandchildren while the parents work or because of, you know, difficult life circumstances. And if you have grandparents who have to bring their grandchildren in when they have VA appointments, it helps them too. So when we improve privacy and environment of care in VA medical centers, to improve things for women veterans because, you know, an 8-man room in the previous era is not going to work for women today. When we improve things to go down to 2-person rooms, that doesn't just benefit women. This is also more beneficial for men today, too, who also have a higher expectation for privacy. So these improvements that we're striving towards are going to serve and help and assist all of our veterans, and we're really excited about helping to raise awareness of how these efforts that we're making will be beneficial for everyone.
Well, we want to certainly thank you, Kayla Williams, for the work that you're doing as director of the VA Center for Women Veterans, and we want to suggest to our veteran radio listeners that they go to www.va.gov/womenvet and check out the Center for Women Veterans. Again, Kayla, thank you for your time today on Veterans Radio.
It was truly my pleasure, and I hope that you have me back sometime.
We certainly hope that you enjoyed our discussion with Kayla Williams. You know a lot more about her now, putting those two interviews together, and you realize that she's really out there passionate for assisting our women veterans, and we'd encourage you to utilize those available resources. We're glad to bring you this programming on WAAM radio out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And next week, Dale will be back But until then, you are dismissed.